get started. Welcome everybody to this symposium on the patient perspectives in tuberculosis care and control. Let's just imagine, just for a little while, for instance, a Chechen girl, young girl, being sick and having cough for already a long time, 8 months, and getting sicker and sicker, and it's like only after these 8 months that she finally be taken to a doctor and she gets diagnosed TB. Then a few weeks later, when she gets interviewed by a social worker, and the social worker asks her actually why it took so long to get to a doctor, then she explains that she had actually been already suspecting she might have TB because she knows some other people with TB. But she was very afraid because she was getting ready to get married, and she was afraid that her fiancé might actually break off the engagement. And actually that happened. And now she's very afraid that she might actually never be able to marry again. We can also think of another type of situation. For instance, then let's go to Southern Sudan. There is a program specifically geared towards a semi-mobile population cattle keepers. And this program then is set up like a Manyata program in a way that patients are kept for 4 months intensive treatment in a treatment, TB treatment camp. And after that, they are discharged with treatment for 3 months still to be taken unsupervised. Well, the outcomes are very good, but for the patients who are enrolled, but what they find out is that there is actually a very low percentage of adult male being enrolled, lower percentage than what you would expect. And this whole program is actually based on the assumption that once people go off with the cattle to the wetter grounds, that you would lose them, that you would lose the contact with them. Now, as it turns out, actually, a little bit further investigation in the matter, it turns out that people, these people, they move in big populations all to fixed cattle camps near the rivers. So actually, you wouldn't have to worry too much because you could actually train DOPS extension workers if you wanted to. Maybe a last small example, completely different again. Let's take a daily laborer somewhere in an African town who gets diagnosed with TB, starts on his treatment, and then after 6 weeks feels much better and doesn't come back again. When he's traced back and asked, yeah, but why didn't you follow the advice? The health worker has been telling you several times that you should actually finish your treatment. Yes, I know it's important, he says, but I need to get some money for my to get food for my family, to pay the rent. And as a daily laborer, if I first have to go, even if I go very early in the morning to the clinic to get my treatment, I miss the chance because by the time I then arrive at the place where all the work is given out, everything is gone. So for me, that's very important. Now, these are all examples, and they show actually that there are many different factors, socioeconomic factors, but also sociocultural beliefs and norms, stigma and the fear for stigma that all influence people's decisions in terms of going for treatment, making use of services. It also shows that the way that the services are set up and also the extent to which the providers can actually respond to the specific needs of people has an influence on whether people can make use of the services as they are. And it lastly also shows, I think, and it's also important to realize that every person is unique and has his own unique needs and priorities. And I think that that then raises the question, and that's the question that we are facing here, is that, what are then those specific needs of people with TB? How can we, and we is then providers, TB specialists, but also I think communities and patients themselves. What can we do all together to guide and support someone through this path from illness towards wellness? And then the last question is, how do we find out what people really need and how they perceive what we're doing? So those are the questions that we are exploring actually in this symposium. And we are doing that in a number of presentations. There is first we will look into research that looks at both patient and provider perspectives on what is quality of services. Then we will look into tools and research around that, tools developed to measure patient satisfaction, client satisfaction. We will hear about peer support and how patient groups can be used in human resource development. We will hear then about stigma and the role that stigma plays in use of services and adherence. And then lastly, we will then get a presentation that goes more into the diversity of needs, the special situations, and also how what consequences does this all, what implication does this have, all that we heard here towards human resource development. So I think we have a very interesting set of presentations before us, so I would like to get started with that quickly. And I would like to, my name is Lucie Blok, as you could see here. I would like now to introduce to you my co-chair, Dr. Chilunga Puta, from the Regional Center for Quality in Healthcare, and she will give the first presentation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I just want to talk about total quality management, both from the perspectives of the care providers and the patient. So what I'll do in this particular presentation is to try to define quality. It's an elusive definition, but we do try to have a working definition. I'll talk about the key dimensions of quality, then go into perspectives of quality, and I want to discuss a little bit why perspective is important in defining quality and what we mean by total quality care. And then I'll just summarize, and I really mean summarize, the PIA quote study, because there are people who are going to talk about that study in more detail, and I don't want to preempt those discussions. And then I'll conclude. So what is quality? Quality has been defined in many different ways by different people. The fathers of quality would say the quality of technical care is the application of medical science and technology in a way that maximizes benefits for health and minimizes risks. Nobody can quarrel with that one. Others say it's doing the right thing in the right way at the right time, however you define right. But one working definition that I think is a little bit more comprehensive and a little bit more clear, I think, is one that is by WHO, which was expounded in 1988, which is the proper performance according to standards of interventions known to be safe, affordable for the society, and that have the capacity to produce an impact on mortality, morbidity, disability, and malnutrition. And I'd like us to note a few things there. One is proper performance. And performance in our world means you're doing something, you're doing it efficiently, and you're getting results out of it. Making an effort does not pass for performance. Interventions that are known to be safe talks about evidence-based. In other words, we're talking about interventions that have an evidence base which supports their safety, particularly. Affordability is important because if a society cannot afford what you're offering, you might as well not be offering it because they cannot access it. And finally, the capacity to produce an impact. Impact is what we are looking for in the TB world, is it not? Yes, we are looking for impact. We want a TB-free world, so we want quality services, and by quality we mean those services that will produce the desired impact. So what are the dimensions of quality? We do look at technical competence, and it's very important that our workers are technically competent to deliver the services that we want. We do look at access to service, and at this point of access, definitely there are areas that have to do with the patient. The patient perspective is particularly important in access because what they think of your service will determine whether they'll come to your service or not, or even whether they'll be willing to spend on accessing your service or not. Effectiveness of services and standards, efficiency of services, interpersonal relations, and in some parts of the world, this is very important, particularly when you think of issues of stigma. Continuity of services, not one day here, next day not here. You know, you want a situation, particularly for diseases like TB, where you want people to come consistently for treatment, you want to ensure continuity of services. Safety, we've alluded to. Amenities, simple amenities, water, environment in which the services are carried out, and choice of services where choice is there. So let's look at the perspectives. There are essentially four perspectives of quality. Perspective, I simply mean point of view. The client and the family may have one particular point of view of what they call quality. The provider will have a different point of view. The healthcare administration and management will look at things differently. And the community may look at things differently, depending on what their culture is like and so on. Let's look at the client. What would the client be interested in? Well, the client would be concerned about technical competence, I'm sure. I don't think I'd like to go to somebody who goes and injects me and kills me in the process. So I would be concerned about their competence. For clients, quality may largely depend on their interaction with providers, how they are greeted, how they are welcomed, how things are explained, how much time they are given to talk about themselves, if they are listened to, if they are respected. Those things will be important to the patient. Privacy. Is it easy to access those services? How long do I have to wait? All those things will matter to a client. On the other hand, the provider may be more concerned about technicalities. Are we providing dots in the right way? Are we following the evidence base? Are our services effective? And in the process of doing that, sometimes we forget that at the receiving end of our service is a human being with intellect, with emotions, and with feelings. And therefore, much as we want to provide a good service, in the end, it is not a good service, in inverted commas, for the recipient. Technically sound, but not acceptable to the person receiving it. Program managers, of course, will be more worried about definitions of what goes into that service. And policymakers and donors will have issues like cost at heart, efficiency, outcomes in the population as a whole. And so we have these different perspectives. I just wanted to run through this very quickly to highlight the different viewpoints and also the different rights and needs. Now, in quality of healthcare, we do say clients have rights. And we do also say providers have needs. What do we mean by that? There are certain things that you should allow a client to have by right. They are not asking for a favor. They have a right to information. They have a right to access to services, And where there is a choice, they have a right to that choice, and they have a right to be informed about the choices that they're making. They have a right to safety, to privacy, to confidentiality, to dignity, to comfort, to continuity of care, and to expression of opinion about the services. On the other hand, for providers to be able to do a good job, they need the training, and we've talked about this in this conference. I think I attended the human resource development session this morning, and it was a highlight. They also need information, updated information. They need adequate infrastructure within which to work, supplies, they need guidance, backup from other levels, respect and recognition, encouragement, feedback, and self-expression. We think in quality of care that these needs and rights need to be honored if really we are going to have a quality healthcare service. Total quality management of TB care. What do we mean by total quality? This is a concept that comes from the total quality management approach to quality of improvement, but adapted for TB. Quality involves everyone and all activities in the healthcare delivery system. You are not going to have a quality service if you leave out any part of that system. Secondly, quality must conformance to standards based on the best practices identified for TB care, as well as meeting the demands of both the internal, that is the workers, and the external clients, that is the patients and the community. And management, we say quality can and must be managed. If we are really looking for results in quality, if we really think that we're going to get rid of TB, then quality must be managed. It's not an option. Because we defined quality as that which produces an impact. And if we're going to have an impact, then we must do what it takes to get that impact. So why then are we bothered about the perspectives in defining quality? Because a comprehensive quality service can only be defined if all perspectives are considered. I didn't say all perspectives are included in the package. They are considered. Okay? Because otherwise, you might end up with a service that actually is good technically, but is not good from the perspective of the patient. We have high defaulter rates, for example, for TB. And sometimes we have those defaulter rates for no other reason than that people are dissatisfied with the service that they receive. I went to that clinic and they insulted me. I may be a TB patient, but I'm still a person. And I'm not putting up with that. And the treatment goes out of the window. Okay? And then we start complaining and we start griping about the development of MDR and XDR. Well, the problem starts from there. What is causing people to go away from your services? Why are they not completing their treatment? Why are they abandoning their treatment? Why are they not coming to the services quickly? So it is very, very important that when we think of quality, we consider the patient's perspective as well. Secondly, all stakeholders should be engaged in some way or another in the process of defining standards. A good quality TB program will not be defined the same in the Netherlands as well as where I come from in the village in Chinsali in Zambia. It will be different. Because our culture is different. Our beliefs are different. Our religious inclinations are different. And those things color the way we think about the acceptability of a service. These things may not be important to me, but they're important to the people I serve. And therefore, they should be taken into account. And the only way that you're going to find out is if you involve your stakeholders. These standards, once defined, must be well articulated and understood by all implementers. One of the things we do find as we go around is sometimes if the standard as defined by the Ministry of Health is not understood by the implementers, They're asking you, why are we doing this? You know? So it is important that they understand. Believe me, health providers do not implement what they don't understand. We've come across this many, many times. Not so much for TB, but I work in malaria as well. And they'll say to you, why do I need to give tablets to a healthy pregnant woman? I'm not going to kill their baby. So they agree. When you give them the guidelines, they say yes. But when it comes to doing, they don't, because they don't understand the standard. So it is important that standards are understood by all. And then healthcare service providers must have the capacity to manage the quality of care aspects of the system. This is a big weakness, particularly where I come from in Africa. It is a very big weakness. People do not have the capacity to manage the quality of care aspects of the system. In most cases, they are not even budgeted for. They are not even in the work plan. But the vision of the Ministry of Health of that particular country is to provide quality healthcare services. Quality that you haven't defined, quality that you haven't budgeted for, quality that you have not planned for. It's a non-starter. It has to be there, and there must be capacity to manage. So what has been done? I'm going through this quickly because I have only got 20 minutes. What has been done? There has been a study in Kenya, Malawi, and Uganda, which Jax will talk about a bit later, to define what is important to the patient. And on the, from the other's perspective, there has also been performance improvement activities using the performance improvement framework in the same countries to look at how to improve health worker performance. This has been two-pronged, and we have engaged those two approaches. Now, when I don't want to talk too much about quote because Jax will talk about it just in a few minutes. When we looked at the performance improvement approach, and we started assessing various health facilities, a number of issues become to emerge. And one of the things is that becomes very obvious is that clients are rarely, if ever, involved in the decision-making process. And sometimes they reject interventions because they don't understand those interventions. We forget that clients have a brain. They think. Secondly, interpersonal relationships is the biggest stumbling block to quality of healthcare. Many clients in their exit interviews in focus group discussions have complained about the reception they get. And some of it is just misunderstanding. For example, we went to a particular hospital and asked about this interpersonal relationships. The hospital thought they were doing a good job. They had a special place where TB people get their drugs. Okay? So they wanted to fast track the TB patients because in their reasoning as health providers, these people were sick people. So they need to move quickly. So they give them a special window to dispense their drugs. Guess what the client's reaction was? They are discriminating against us. Now they are putting us in a special queue so everybody knows we are TB patients. So we don't want to go to this hospital because they're discriminating against us. Do you see the different perspectives? The health providers are doing their best, trying to help these people to move quickly. The target of the service felt they were being discriminated against. So it is very important. Standards of care for TB mainly address good detection and treatment of cases where we've been, but it pays inadequate attention to these relationships and to patient comfort, to patient support beyond case management. Socio-psychological support is there in some countries, but very limited, and mechanisms for feedback from the client are often inadequate. Sometimes you do see a little box which says suggestion box, but nobody ever reads the suggestions, and let alone act on the suggestions, okay? Health service providers will claim to be client-focused, but in reality, it is a service provider-focused service. It is concerned about what the health provider sees as quality, not necessarily what the client sees as quality. Counseling and information flow is inadequate, although there are standards to address this issue, but it is in the doing of it, it is inadequate. Now, when you looked at the court angle in terms of the outcomes, again, you find that the patients rank very highly interpersonal relationships, procedures and competence of providers, availability and accessibility of free services, and there's a reason why they say free, infrastructure, patient support, and clear explanation of the HIV-AIDS-TB relationship. Now, on the last one, in the PIA, we found that health providers are not willing to talk about it. They don't want really to talk about the relationship between TB and HIV, okay? So you can see that there are overlaps between the client expectation and the health provider focus. That's true, there are overlaps, there are areas of agreement, but there are also areas of disparity that lead to client dissatisfaction with services. And this gives rise to the negative outcomes in patient care that we observe. Standards of care that do not take into account patient perspectives are likely to lead to a rejection of the services by the target of those services. And we have found this in our focus group discussions. People will move from health facility to another health facility. And sometimes when they move to another health facility, they do not tell the new health facility what happened at the previous health facility. And that messes up their, their treatment. I've been told my time is up, so thank you very much for your attention. And I've also been told I have to call the next speaker. So I'll ask Dr. Van den Broek to come over and present his paper on using patients' perspective in improving performance of providers, PIA Code 2 for assessment. Dr. Van den Broek is a senior consultant for KNCV. He has worked with many countries in Africa, has worked with us on the Code and PIA project, and he will give you some of the actual findings of the study that I alluded to in my presentation. Dr. Van den Broek.
Thank you very much, Chilunga. I'm very grateful to have been invited to present this in this forum, and I'm also very grateful to have been in the position to work with Chilunga in the field in three countries. As you have seen, she's a very inspiring person and hitting the nail exactly on the head where it is needed. I'm going to take you through a tool which is called QUOTE, and that stands for Quality of Care Seen Through the Patient's Eyes. It's a bit crooked abbreviation, but it sounds so good. And it is an existing framework, which I will going to explain to you briefly before I will tell you something about how we apply this tool for tuberculosis control. So what QUOTE is, it's a tool to measure performance of the healthcare system in order to promote patient perspectives, so as to also empower patient organizations. It is based on expectations or what patients perceive as important. And it is then also compared to how we do in order to get an impact or an improvement score. The framework has a fixed general component, but also a cultural setting specific component, like Chilunga already said. What is important to a TB patient in Sweden is not necessarily the same as one in Sudan. It also has disease specific components, and in this case we talk about TB. It's developed for chronic diseases, and for most aspects, we can consider TB as one of the chronic diseases. Well, in TB, we are rather quantitatively oriented with all our indicators and so forth. So I could not restrain from showing you this. This is the basis of the quote tool. Huh? You measure quality by weighing your performance with what patients perceive as important. So the importance here, the expectation of patient, is the weighing factor. It addresses the following dimensions: the availability, accessibility, continuity, cost, accommodation, and so forth, which is the health structure, but also the processes, and like I said, the specific cultural and disease aspects. Now, the importance aspect is basically measured only once, because we think that what patient expects from us doesn't change overnight. And we do that, or we did that, with focus group discussion and interviews. And the big dimensions, which are also shown by Chilunga, what we did, we ranked them using picture cards. And the sub-dimension, or the items, we ranked them through rating procedure. The performance is measured through routine interviews on a day-to-day basis with patients. And for the sake of ease of analysis, we have closed questions with four possible answers so that we can easily measure how many of the clients indicated a negative performance. Now, the importance score in our research came out as the following three: not important, important, and extremely important, with the cut-off point between the important and the extremely important. And also from our research with social scientists from the three countries, Malawi, Kenya, and Uganda, showed that indeed it is culturally completely acceptable to put the cut-off point there, because people tend to give favorable answers to questions. Well, this result is then transformed in a scale of 1 to 10. 10 is most important. The performance we measure, like I said, through interviews. Also here, the patient is given four options to answer, or two when it is appropriate. And this is also done to be able to dichotomize the results. We want to know how many patients are happy with the service and how many are not happy with the service. Again, for ease of analysis. Here I show you an example of an existing publication among HIV patients in the Netherlands. And what you see here is the following aspects taken seriously: confidentiality about the HIV status, to be allowed to ask a second opinion, to break news gently, and having short waiting times. In this column is the importance or the expectations of patients. And you can see that to have to wait for longer than 50 minutes is not so important to patients. They don't mind. But what they do mind is to be taken seriously. And somewhere in the middle is to be allowed to ask a second opinion. So the importance score is 6 on a scale of 1 to 10, somewhere in the middle. Now, if you looked how we did as health providers, then you can see that the confidentiality was not an issue. The product of these two gives you a 0, means that there's nothing to be gained there. But on the other hand, if you look at allowed to be ask a second opinion, then 73% of the patients interviewed said this was a serious issue. And if you multiply these two, you get a very high impact or quality score. So for health providers who want to really take the patient perspective into consideration, this would be something to address first. Also, other people think that it's important to have a second opinion. Yeah, it's a funny thing that you were laughing about it. Okay, now how do we interpret this quality impact score? In general, if you have a score of 1, that means that approximately 50% of the respondents give you an average answer. So that doesn't say so much. So the issue is the ones with a much higher score or with a much lower score give you the most information. So there is an approach to focus on the highest impact score like we did with the HIV example. But there are also other possible means to do. For example, some important factors are so important that no client should score less than 5%. Okay, then that was the general introduction about the QUOTE tool. Let's go to the development of the QUOTE TB tool. The important dimensions which came out of our research among 675 patients, or I must say even more, was the following list of quality dimensions. And as you can see, Chilunga also mentioned them. They are quite universal. Availability or accessibility of services, to be informed, to have a friendly provider interaction, and also to be counseled. The relationship between TB and HIV/AIDS, the amenities, procedures and tests, cost and payments, and support. The funny thing is the support came out strongly from the research, and also in the patient charter, which is presented in this Congress also, it seems to be a patient right to have support in terms of food, with cash for transportation, in addition to psychological and social support. Now, in our research, we made use of a number of cards which were drawn by a Tanzanian artist when asked, give us a picture of what you mean with good accessibility, with information, TB-HIV relationship, patient-provider interaction, and so forth. So here you have an example of the cards which were used in the field to rank the importance of those dimensions. And what we are planning to do with these cards is to either produce them as a poster for all clinics in order to trigger a dialogue between health providers and patients about what issues are important and how could we improve this. Now, those 8 dimensions mentioned, below them are the items, and I give you just one example because of time constraints. For example, the patient-provider interaction and counseling, what was perceived as very important by patients was the respect and dignity. And this is also in the patient charter as a patient right, that providers listen carefully to them, explain things in an understandable way, that there is sufficient time for discussion, how to deal with the problems, the counseling, explain how TB can affect your everyday life, that there should be no discrimination because of tuberculosis, and that the privacy is respected. Now, the important score of the dimensions and all of the sub-items was established through ranking, as I said, and through rating. And the results of this study has been tested for reliability and for scalability of the items. And this is what came out of 2 countries as perceived most important by the patients. And as you can see, and that is also according to expectation, everything is important. The only thing is a few things are even more important than others. But there is no big difference between the countries, and analysis which we have so far shows also that there is no big difference between cultural setting or educational level. But the details we are going to produce soon. I give you an example of the existing QUOTE TB importance tool, for example, availability of services, and then these questions are asked, and the patient are asked to rate them, either not important, important, or extremely important. Married with this important tool is the performance tool, which addresses, of course, the same items. And here the patients are asked, how do we perform? Were the waiting times acceptable for you before being served? Never, sometimes, usually, always. So here we want to get a response of how well did we do. And here are examples of the analysis of the CoTB tool from three countries, Malawi, Kenya, and Uganda. For example, the dimension information. Do health providers tell you about the curability of TB? The performance we measured was that only 2% of the patients said that they were not satisfied with our services. Given an important score of 6.4, give you an impact score of 0.13, well below 1. Interaction with the provider and the patient, between provider and patient, and counseling, one of the examples was, do health providers at this facility tell you how TB can affect your everyday life? And then 20% of the respondents said, well, we are not so happy with this aspect of the services. And it was quite important to them. This gives you an impact score of 1.41. Last example, patients really want the providers to provide support with food. And what you can see here is that the importance score is just average. So although it is a patient right and appeared to be very important, in our study it was important but not so. But the performance was really not so good, just simply because the NTP programs which we examined didn't have a food support program, except for a few clinics in the big town in Nairobi, where it existed. Otherwise, it would have been one. And then you see here, that gives you a high impact score, meaning that if you start providing food to the patient, you immediately improve your services from the perspective of the patient. Now, I will end up with telling you a few advantages and a few disadvantages of the CoTB tool. One of the most important advantages, according to our team, is that it adds the essential patient perspective to improve services. Like Chilung has already said, that is often missing in the equation. And from the TB world, we are sensitive to these arguments, but we also want to be able to quantify to see how you can improve. And this tool is, in a way, easy to compute and analyze once it is there. The research to get the tool was took quite some breath, but once it is there, we think that it should be easy to use. It also could be adapted to other settings, other cultural settings, by just repeating focus group discussion to see what are the important issues in different cultural settings. And it can be routinely used in supervision visits if you want to compare districts and to compare large health facilities, because in order to use the tool, you need a certain sample size. If it is used in national NTP reviews, then you are sure that you have a big enough sample. Then you have a tool to standardize assessment of the patient's perspective in the country. And finally, not mentioned here, is if you can use it on an individual patient basis as a standardized client exit interview under the performance improvement approach, which Chilunga just mentioned. There are also some disadvantages which we know now, some of which we may be still able to address, and there may even be more disadvantages coming up as we go. The framework is flexible, meaning that if you want to use it as a research tool, that comparison between different settings may be difficult. Another one is that not all relevant dimensions are always represented in a reliable way. This comes out if you do this psychometric testing once you have established these items and the dimensions. As I already mentioned, all items seem to be important because that's what you ask the patient, what is important. Now you get the answer, everything is important. But what we are interested in, what is more important than something else? The cultural issues in answering I addressed already. Sample size I also mentioned to you. And one of the criticisms we got is that we don't address the non-participants, the ones who don't come to the services. But that is an inherent problem of the tool because it deals with chronic diseases attending to making use of the health service. Finally, I want to thank and acknowledge the institutions having been doing this research, and that is actually under the umbrella of the Tuberculosis Coalition Tuberculosis Coalition for Technical Assistance, as mentioned here, which is more funded by the USAID. The QUO tool was originally developed by the NIVEL, which is an institute in the Netherlands dealing with first-line research and care. The Royal Tropical Institute, Chilunga, of the Regional Center of Quality of Healthcare in Kampala, and finally my organization, the Cancer and Tuberculosis Foundation. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Jax. I think we'll keep the questions to the end of the session. So I'll call upon Olav. Olav is a communications advisor in the Norwegian Heart and Lung Patient Organization. And he's going to talk to us about patient empowerment, the role of peer work. Olav.
Thank you. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to come here and speak about this today. And thank you all for coming to listen. I work in LHL, who started as a TB patient association more than 60 years ago. And we started working internationally with TB 20 years ago, when TB was almost forgotten in Norway. Then we started working with NTPs, but the last few years we have sort of gotten back to the roots, looking into a more patient-centered approach. Actually, as you see, I'm going to speak more about empowerment than peer work. And we would like to demystify, or at least I would like to do that, demystify the word empowerment. What does it mean? We asked ourselves the questions, what is it? What does it mean? And how can we use it to improve TB control? And what is the effect of it? The answer is slightly given in the title, Peer Work and Health Communication. So I speak from a work in progress, so things have been changed a long way since I started writing the abstract that you had in your books. I think most of you have the speaking notes handed out already, so you can make notes there if you want. So let's see where this takes us. I think this is a good illustration of how we define peer work. Anna, who you will see to the right, is a former TB patient who turned peer worker. She lives in Windhoek, Namibia. She's with one of many former TB patients who use their experiences and their own stories to teach new patients about TB and how to cope with it. She has the ability to establish a relation to and contact with patients. And research has shown that former TB patients are the best treatment supporters. Peer work and health communication are the tools that we use to empower the patients. But what is it? This is how former TB patients define empowerment when asked. This was from a workshop in Zambia that we held earlier this year. And we asked people from four different countries, Zambia, Tanzania, Namibia, Malawi, how do you define it? And this is what they said. From Zambia, they said, enabling patients to take care of their own treatment and their own health. Others said, after treatment, we want to assist them to have the right environments for productivity. Look at how to strengthen the patient's lives, both during and after treatment. Listen to this one, after treatment as well. This is something that is not in the DOT strategy, actually. And from Malawi, they said, people enabled to participate in TB treatment and control. Listen to these words. Control over your own life, participation, freedom. Aren't these all the words that we also would like to use in our own lives? This is a normal setting. And it goes back to what Dr. Chilunga said as well on her comments on quality. I think this is what we all want. So the question we asked us was, how can we as NGOs and ministries of health and others work to facilitate this? Some of the answers so far has been to facilitate peer work, development of IEC material, that is information, education and communication material, in close cooperation with the users, the patients themselves. They have been developing the material along with us. And health communication training for health workers. This is another set of definition, as you will find in a recently published literature review made by Jean Mack. It will be available in very few days. It was supposed to be printed for this conference. I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure whether it's still available. It's going to be available in a few days from the Stop TB website and from the WHO, and from my own website, the LHL, of course. Yeah, I won't see anything more about that one. So, how to empower patients? The question we asked the patients was, what do you want to know about TB? This is a draft, a set of six different booklets that came out of that question. They had a lot of different questions that what we imagined. They wanted to know, can we have sex when we have TB? What about my job? Can I still go to work when I have TB? All those kind of questions we never imagined, and they would be different from country to country. So this is a draft set of booklets. You can have a look at it afterwards. I only have one set, so I'll have to keep it. But we'll be happy to make it available for you all later on. And we'd also have available manuals for pre-testing and development of communication material, which we'll be happy to distribute and inform you about. The material was developed by a consultant who's been working in WHO for a long time, Ms. Anna Holland. So, the patient defined the content of the materials. This was done in a particular way, including pre-testing the material, as I said. And by good use of the document, I mean empowering the patient was something we could see from the process of developing the material with the patients. But there is another factor. What about the material afterwards? Can I just give it to the patients, read it? Can I give it to a health staff person and say, read it to the patient? No, this is not what it's about. It should be used, or at least we think that is more effective. It should be used in a setting where, for example, a former TB patient and the patient sit together in the family, for instance, and go through the information. This facilitates a real dialogue where the patient can give, provide questions and comment and relate the booklets and the information there to their own situation. And that might even give feedback for a new change of the material. So this is not a static material. It's always a process, an ongoing process. Why health communication? Lessons we learned from the developing of booklets on TB was that it empowered patients. It built capacity on how to pretest and how to analyze and use the pretesting or information from the pretesting. An operational study carried out in Temeke, Tanzania, by two nurses students in January 2006 found that the health workers spent less than 1 minute per patient. Of course, there's a shortage of staff. The nurses were rude, harsh, and their main task was to give DOT, which they did. They gave the tablets, they observed it. So they did that well. But after health communication training that we carried out for health workers there in February, the patients said they had noticed a positive change of attitude towards them. They don't use harsh language anymore, was a message we got from the patients reporting back from the training. The patients were asked their opinion and if they had questions. And through this, taking the people, the patients, seriously, that led to an opening up, which led to vital information, and then leading to changes in the way treatment was given, and I think with improved results. A study in Zambia by Alec Nirenda from CHEP, the Copperbelt Health Education Project, showed that former TB patients are better treatment supporters than any without the lived experience. Patients with what we could call risky behavior, that would be tobacco, heavy smoking, drinking, they preferred not to go to health workers because they got this index finger, don't drink, don't smoke. No, they went to former TB patients or other health workers, and they felt they were treated with respect. In Panduka TB project in Namibia, they also make use of former TB patients, as we saw in the photo of Anna and the old woman. So by using triangulation, we used three different methods, we found that a real change had taken place. Both the patients, the health workers, and the supervisors of the health workers reported the same. They had changed the attitude and the behavior towards the patients. Triangulation is one of the research methods we use in all our health and communication projects. We apply several methods, and this is just one of them. Are the results reliable? Yes, we think so, based on what you can see here. I mentioned the use of triangulation. All methods we use are in a family of action research approaches and qualitative methods. The purpose is to find, is the direction we're in, we're at, correct? If not, what changes can be done? How can we improve, and where should the improvements be done? Empowerment is important for the patient and his family, the larger community, and the healthcare systems and TB control programs. We know all the constraints in the DOT strategy and the shortage of staff, the co-infection, the stigma, the TB, HIV, all these things. So LHL, we see our role as to promote this work and to facilitate learning and contribute to the sharing of these activities. This is an example of communicating with health workers. Time is a bit short, so I will just show that the experience with using health workers, with the lived experience, has given very good results. In Zambia, they have been working with traditional healers who had TB themselves, and they proved to be a lot better providers than others as well. And in fact, in a study there, it proved they had zero defaulters, and all the people in the study actually are on treatment or have been cured. This is an example again from Namibia, a lady, Mrs. Sane, receiving a certificate of achievement. She has fulfilled her treatment, which was done in a setting where patients came together for a handicraft project. So they learned a profession and they were given a food scheme. But the most important thing they reported was just coming together with people in the same situation. They could exchange experiences on how to cope with the disease. That was the most important part of it. I won't say much about this one. Conclusions. Speaking openly is important, but ought to be structured and targeted. To achieve this, our experience is that TB patients need to train in support groups. Openness is very important, but again, it needs training. Understandable and useful information that speaks of the problems the patients experience, not of what the health workers think is important. That is the most efficient. The process of developing and testing the material is empowering the participants. So developing awareness of one's own communication habits and the effects of these on the patients lead to health workers relating to patients as individuals, not as objects. The methods we have used have facilitated respect. So peer work and health communication do contribute to TB control and care. Thank you for your attention.
Ginny is a social anthropologist. She's based in Zambia. She's working for the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the Zambat Project. And she's just going to tell us about the effect of stigma on access to and use of TB services. Thank you, Ginny.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to Kit for sponsoring me to come to the conference. I'm talking today on the basis of a review of literature on TB and stigma, and also on the basis of work that I carried out in Zambia in 2002 on urban and rural stigma, including HIV stigma, including TB stigma. So stigma is the social process of combining the presence of a biological disease in a person or group with a perceived notion of culpability. And Harriet Deakin came up with this very nice definition that disease stigma is negative social baggage associated with a disease. And I think what's important here is the idea of disease as a just punishment for ill doings. Key elements of stigma that are important to briefly highlight is that distinctions are often made between felt or perceived stigma. This is stigma that you anticipate may happen to you. And then people talk about enacted stigma, which is actual experiences of stigma. And then internalized stigma, which is when people internalize stigma to the extent that you actually perceive that you do have a spoilt identity. And there's a very strong element of shame in this. Stigma has a tendency to reinforce pre-existing inequalities and social divisions. An example of this was a poster I looked at today on gypsies in Romania and how they face stigma as gypsies, but also if they have TB, then another layer of stigma. And this brings me to the next point, that there is often multi-layered stigma. It is cultural specific, and it is disease specific, but there is very definitely sort of commonalities in the experience and impact of disease stigma. I also want to make the point that it can be used too loosely in public health. And this has really come about since HIV has taken up stigma, luckily. But in the result, people sort of give it lip service, and it's applied to a wider range of negative actions and intentions and restrictions. And this makes it hard to act against. But one thing I want you to go away with is that stigma can be unpacked into sort of actionable, manageable parts. And I think the most useful way to think about it as programmers is to think about causes, experiences, consequences, and coping strategies. And I want to make the point, I'm having a bit of fun here with a cross-section of a microbacteria cell wall, but the point here is that stigma is part of a wider context. And that context dictates the causes of stigma and the shape, the forms that it takes. For example, in the context of HIV, TB stigma becomes much bigger. But there'll be another context where TB stigma might fall away. For example, someone called Mark Nichter did very nice work in detention camps in the US, where actually, alongside being in these camps and other issues, having TB simply wasn't stigmatized. So today I'm looking at the consequences of stigma in relation to TB and people accessing TB services. And I think the literature shows us, and this is mainly qualitative research, that stigma is one reason that people delay health seeking. They delay getting diagnosed with TB and also leads them sometimes to shop around for treatment from elsewhere. And this has been shown in many different countries. And I think from this conference and from findings here, you could add the Philippines and China to this list here. From my own work in Zambia, in the context of HIV, people who suspect that they have TB are now more likely to hide from the health services, to go to traditional healers or elsewhere. And there is a widespread recognition that this has negative consequences, that indeed you can die by hiding. And people are sort of juggling, you know, do they expose their moral self or do they go and get treatment? Once diagnosed, stigma is another reason why people deny that they have it or that they hide their diagnosis. And again, this has been shown very widely. And although I'm just looking at consequences, I think it's important to say, you know, why? Why do people do this? And in the Zambian study, it was the fear of being thought to have AIDS, of being isolated, of being rejected, neglected, and shamed. As a businesswoman in Lusaka said, it is on rare occasions that TB patients tell their status. Because as a community, when we see someone has TB, we say they have AIDS. And so they decide to keep it to themselves for fear of being isolated. But this is not only fear. Their fears are real. There's very widespread documented evidence of TB patients, TB patient households and their families, and health workers working with TB facing discrimination as a direct result of TB in many countries in the world. And there is also some indications of the adverse impact of TB-related stigma on psychological well-being. This is a drawing by a 14-year-old street girl from the research that I did in 2002. And this is a very common form of stigma that I'm sure you're all familiar with. It's also a very common prevention measure, and I think we need to reflect on the necessity of these measures throughout the period of treatment. So there's a TB patient and two other people are staying far away from the patient because they don't want to be infected with the disease. And just very quickly to say that the most common experiences around stigma across many diseases, including TB, is around devaluation, exclusion, and disadvantage, with the overlap between the three being the most intense. And I think many of you can imagine that TB patients and medical encounters may anticipate or indeed may experience all three. Stigma also has an impact on treatment, and it's been one reason for interrupting treatment and for refusing directly observed therapy. There is evidence that health providers are propagating stigma in Nicaragua, Zambia, and from the Philippines. There's a very nice poster outside from Mitchell Weiss and his group's work. And there's also evidence that some TB prevention measures are unnecessary and are prolonged and are stigmatizing in some countries. I think it's also important to consider gender and stigma. And there is evidence that being identified as a TB patient has more negative consequences for women, particularly in Asia, and that women have more negative feelings at diagnosis, that they're more scared of rejection. But also the recent gender and TB study that was done shows that men feel they have more to lose from the loss of social status, which is another dimension here. So it's important to understand the differences to design effective responses. So it is possible to act against stigma and to reduce stigma. And as we've heard in the previous presentation on patient empowerment, I think that structural improvements have an impact on reducing stigma, and the quality of care presentation, I think, sort of demonstrates that very nicely. But I also think we need to develop specific participatory anti-stigma education for TB programs. That's both for providers, for patients, for the affected households, and for the communities. And this is particularly critical in areas with high HIV prevalence. And I think something that's very special or specific to TB stigma is that we need to address the legitimate and non-legitimate fears of TB transmission. and also that we need to integrate anti-stigma education into a wider strategy of TB patient empowerment. There are some provider tools that are being developed at the moment by Jean-Marc, also by ICRW with the CORE initiative, and by the ZAMSTAR study, which I'm currently working on. And we've just got top-up funding to adapt a HIV anti-stigma toolkit to TB, and to add, we want to develop it as a TB module to fit into this existing toolkit. I think it's also important to address in anti-stigma education other specific misconceptions that have a detrimental effect on people, on patients and the public health alike. So, for example, TB is not curable in a person living with HIV. We also need to develop tools to evaluate whether we're being successful in reducing stigma interventions. And there has been some preliminary work done on this, and there is some work going on in Thailand at the moment. Mitchell Weiss has done a study where he used some psychometric indicators. And I'm also now doing a study which includes some psychometric indicators on stigma and interventions to see if they reduce stigma. And what I suggest is that you think about this in the same way that the HIV community has thought about it. And as you see, I've adapted some work done by the HIV community on measuring HIV stigma to TB. And I think it's useful if you think about it in these domains. So domains for diagnosed TB patients would be enacted stigma. An example of that is being excluded from a social gathering. Issues around disclosure, whether people are concealing their TB diagnosis. Also issues around internal stigma, whether you feel guilty, for example, about having TB, and how people are coping with stigma. And then the other domains are for the sort of TB-affected households or for the community. And I'd like you just to notice that this includes, in HIV prevalence settings, the association between TB and HIV, which is really making TB stigma much sort of deeper. And I think we need to also have not only sort of quantitative tools, but qualitative tools to evaluate the reduction of stigma. So in conclusion, I would say, having done a review, that there is a real gap in research literature around stigma, TB stigma. And what you see is that there isn't often enough a sort of combination of theory and good empirical research, that you get it as a sort of secondary or incidental finding in TB literature, but not very rarely a very strong focus on it. And I think we need a combination, although we have some qualitative evidence, we don't have much quantitative, and I think it would be much more powerful if we could combine the two. I think there's new questions coming with the ARV rollout and how this might impact TB stigma. And I think we need to think also about how to adapt anti-stigma tools for TB and for what I call TB-HIV. And we need to develop and pilot quantitative and qualitative evaluation tools to measure how to reduce stigma, or if we are reducing stigma. And as the speakers before me have said, is that decreasing stigma will lead to improved health outcomes. This is something that we should care about. And it will make having tuberculosis and HIV less dehumanizing. As an HIV-positive woman cured of TB in Lusaka said, TB patients are also people, because it's not that when someone suffers from TB, they're not a person. And this is an education message from a 12-year-old boy, reminding us that TB is an airborne disease, but a person cannot get infected once the patient's on treatment, and that both TB and AIDS patients need proper care. They don't need to be separated because of their status. What they need is encouragement and care. I'd like to acknowledge the research assistants and the other researchers that I work with on the stigma research, my Zambia colleagues, the Zambian health authorities and partners, the funders of the stigma research, USA, DFID and Swedish CEDA, colleagues from the London School, and finally the current funders of my post, which is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation within the CREATE Consortium and DFID. Thank you.
And the next presentation is by Ank Kwak. She's a social scientist. We've been working with Ank for some time now. And that paper is actually co-authored with Marlene Dillerman, who's a public health specialist. And recently, Ank has done a systematic review, yes, on sexual counseling for WHO. And she's very concerned about issues of patients and patients' perspectives. And Marlene has produced a very good paper on human resource development, particularly performance of health workers. So Ank is going to present to us a paper entitled Adapting TB Human Resource Development to the Specific Needs of Specific Populations.
We actually have a new title, but
how
that
could
was,
you?
It was difficult to integrate it into the program. And thank you, Shilunga. We are very, very happy to talk here together, Marjolein and I. We actually will talk on exploring approaches to include human capacity in TB care. And at this moment in time, I think there's in the TB world, in TB care and control, more attention given to the human factor. And we will talk very shortly on international and the international context and show that there's real attention now for the human factor. We will talk shortly on new approaches, and that will be focused on patient perspectives. Then on, we will do the analysis and see that there are actually three major challenges in our perspective. And then we will go to the provider perspective and give conclusions and recommendations. As you all know, maybe from the WHO poverty tool, the definition is given that poor and vulnerable groups with barriers to TB are those people in absolute economic poverty and people disadvantaged by gender-related factors, marginalized ethnic groups, and people in remote areas. And besides that, also in this tool, the need for problem analysis is mentioned, and also that it's important to identify and determine barriers in access to care. In the international context, we see actually that the time is there to really focus on patients and see that the most poor patients are actually addressed in goal one of the UN Millennium Development Goals. That's the one on poverty reduction. And we have goal six on TB reduction. Also in the World Development Report published in 2004, it was mentioned that health services work better as they put patients at the center of service provision. Recently, in the field of TB, we have seen some major developments and achievements. First, already poverty tool is actually addressing poverty in TB control, and it gives options for national TB programs, how to address that. Also, in the international standards of care, in which the 2006 patient charter for tuberculosis and care, the patient rights and responsibility are mentioned and underlined. And you see that the rights and responsibility, I'm not going to mention them again. I think they were today mentioned by several of the former speakers. What you see at this time is that there's a real interest in human capacity and there are new approaches happening. I myself and Royal Tropical Institute also, Marjolein and I were involved in the development of the QUOTE tool, which was described by Jacques. In this, there is a patient perspective, an assessment of patient perspective on quality of care. And actually, before developing the dimensions that was part of the instrument Jacques presented, we did extensive qualitative research in the three countries. And the QUOTE tool is a new start, but of course we are still not interviewing suspects. We are not interviewing defaulter patients, so we're not seeing all the patients. Then we have the poverty tool. It's very interesting to see the book by WHO, and you see that there are many new nice things mentioned, but there are not still, not there's not any talk on the perceptions and the priorities of the patients themselves. So again, it's about patients, over patients, but not what their ideas are. You see also, and that's the theme of this conference, that on human resources, there's more attention for performance of providers, but still the linkage between providers and patients is not there. We talked about stigma reduction strategies, but they're not so much operational in TB settings. When we were preparing this paper, we actually came up with challenges, and I think there's a new also for our own work. We see there are new directions, and of course, the first focus is on perception and priorities of people living with TB. The second one is stigma reduction strategies in TB, and the third one, the relationship between patients and providers. When you look at what's happening in the field of patients, you actually see that there's very little interest in the question, when does one really become a TB patient? And what does that mean for the TB patient, him or herself? In the whole process, and I think that comes more from anthropology, there's the idea when you become ill, there's a transcription of symptoms to an illness or a label. You feel, what do patients feel and how do they describe their suffering? How do they feel that they should take the medicines? How do they feel what actions they should take? And are this treatment, is it accepted by themselves? Also, I think there's very little research going on the deconstruction of the concept of a TB patient. Is that a person who is poor, marginalized? We talk also in the poverty tool, we talk on groups of patients, but we're not focusing on the individual patient. And I think it's very important to continue to discuss this diversity and difference in terms of gender, age, and class and identity. Also, I think it's very important for providers to have a better understanding of what patients feel and see. And you see also in the former presentation, there's a lot on what is happening, what is important to empower patients, but not on their, maybe on their ideas. The other thing is stigma reduction. And I think I will skip that a little bit because Ginny talked about that a lot. But I think that people are surprised that there has been so little research going on TB and stigma, and that actually perceived and acted stigma leads to delay in presentation, it leads to poor adherence. We have examples from our own research that patients state that actually taking medicine confirms that they really are a patient. It confirms the identity of being a patient, and that's why people stop taking their treatment. Also, it leads to default from treatment. In that perspective, also it's important, I think also Ginny mentioned it already, that often intersecting identities are at stake. We are not only talking on the TB patient. The TB patient is also a parent or a father or a worker. And at the moment, the people disclose that they are TB patients, the other identities are also influenced by that. It's for sure that there's a need for strategies to reduce stigma in TB. Another challenge is certainly the relationship between patients and providers. And I think from our quote study, especially from our qualitative study, this relationship came to the fore very clearly. In our quote study, we held several focus group discussions in the three countries. And in four focus group discussions in Uganda, people believe that TB is caused by witchcraft that was mentioned in those focus group discussions. And they also mentioned that they thought that herbal medicine was the only cure and that TB drugs actually catalyzed deaths of the TB patients. This is, of course, very important to act upon by providers and others. Also, I'm very much, my own research is really going into pain and concepts of pain. And I did enter the whole TB world not so long ago, but I'm still surprised that there are not real qualitative study on how people, the TB patients or people living with TB, actually perceive the pain of TB. And of course, there are very interesting instruments to actually to do so. And what you also see is that there are actually a clash between explanations of illness and disease. Of these clashes we saw also in our own studies for the quote instruments. And I think those clashes are have to be dealt with. Another challenge, I think, in the whole field of TB care is providers as patients. We are now in our work at KIT, we're entering research on narrative of providers living with HIV. And I think it will be also very interesting to enter the field of providers as being patients with TB and how they deal with that. It's very important to link the patients with the providers. Providers are often part as the same cultural context as the patients. But what you see, what we saw in the research, is that they either recognize the labels and the beliefs of patients or deny them. And we have to do something with that. Marjolein?
As you can see, we share this presentation, so I continue from here onwards. I'm continuing on another angle. Apart from the fact that it is important to look at providers as patients as they can be, providers work in systems and they are often failing health systems. I think you all know, and I was very happy to see that in the DOT strategy now, an extra part is to strengthen health systems as also TB programs work through health systems. And what you see that there are many harmful practices that are conducted by health providers because they have inappropriate competencies, because they have a low income, because they are not satisfied with their jobs. And because of this, they have various coping mechanisms that adversely affect patients. And then, of course, the marginalized group who have no voice and who are not really able to stand up for themselves are suffering the most from that. Examples of coping mechanisms, I think, you are all very well aware of. There's many publications, many anecdotal stories as well about under-the-table payments, illegal sale of drugs, referring to your own private clinic in the evening, so a patient has to pay more for that, absence from services, so you can earn extra money in order to, for instance, by consultancies or attending training courses or doing business at the market, why not? Rude behavior, we've heard it before from the previous presenters because providers might not know how to deal with the disease, how to explain it, not explaining things to patients. We did a research in Uganda and there were actually surgeons who skipped operations because they were scared of being infected with HIV/AIDS. So not treating patients is also a coping mechanism of dealing with the disease or with the patients. And not adherence to protocols. I think that's a well-known example, especially in the private sector, but it probably also happens in the public sector at times. Well, of course, I think these problems have been mentioned time and again in various parts of the conference, and what we are all, of course, interested in is how can we deal with it? What should we do? And one of the things that have been coming across many times in the various presentations throughout this conference is training. And, of course, training is extremely important. What I think is important to look at is what are alternative ways to give competencies to providers. How can we better assure in a cost-effective way that people stay on site? Because with an enormous human resource crisis that there is at the moment, you can't afford that people go away for weeks on end on training. And various research have shown that off-site training, so training in another place, is not very effective. So here you have a number of examples that you can try that have been experimented with in a number of places of helping providers to gain competencies on-site and at the same time being able to practice it in their own work, such as on-the-job training, supportive supervision, clinical meetings where you talk with each other about cases that you have met, and ask help from a doctor from a hospital, for instance, or from another department. Peer support, distance learning, performance assessment tools that you do with each other. These are all examples that are often more effective than off-site training courses. Then the other weak point that can create, or that often creates, harmful practices is a lack of support at work. I think you all know about that. There's no blueprint, unfortunately, and I know, as I think Jacques already earlier said, in the TB control world, it's nice to work with algorithms, with data, and knowing what to do, but as long as the human element is any programs, there are no blueprints to deal with it. And I'm afraid that you all have to accept that and have to try as you go along with what fits in your best, in your own environment best, and learn and try and see with the lessons learned from others how you can use it in your own situation. Examples are safety at work. Of course, people are extremely concerned to get infected while they're treating patients. This is for AIDS, but also for TB. So how can you help them in a better way? And then it's not only by providing protective measurements, but also communicating on their use. Because, for instance, in Uganda and in Zambia, where we did research, gloves were all the time out of stock. But then somebody said as well, well, listen, we see providers putting on 3 pairs of gloves and letting the family members of the patients do the work because they were concerned of getting infected. So it's also the management of protective measures. Equipment and supplies, not only making sure that you have enough equipment, but you also maintain and make people responsible for it. Clear communication about what's happening in your own facility at the central level, and also feedback from the patients. It is important we did research, and health providers in Mali, for instance, found it very important to receive feedback from what patients thought about the way they were treated. It is an extra incentive to hear that your actions have been appreciated. Management capacities and leadership, of course. I think Chilunga mentioned that already at the start of this meeting. At lower level facilities, it's well known that very qualified doctors are appointed as managers, but then they're not immediately good managers. So they need help, they need tools and support at the workplace. The off-site training programs are not the only solution for that. Next one is involvement of health workers in strategies to improve job satisfaction. In motivation research, it has shown that, yes, money is very important, but not the most important part. Recognition, responsibility, being able to feel that your work has contributed to something is also an important tool. And if you involve people in trying to find out what you can do to make your colleagues stay at the workplace, you already contribute to a kind of motivation. And if you have limited resources, if you share that with each other, you create also responsibility to try and deal with that. And, of course, redistribution of tasks. If there is a heavy workload, there might be a lot of what we call untapped resources. You can look around and find within the community how you can better work together. A team for today is not only including patient planning and implementation of your activities, but then actively involving them. They can, with peer support, you can achieve a lot. And the last part that I think as a coping mechanism is introducing accountability systems. So people are being held responsible for their performance towards their colleagues, towards their managers, and towards the patients. There are various options for that that haven't been tried out sufficiently. The paper that I wrote, I read a lot of different studies. And for instance, development of a regulatory framework is an important tool. But if you don't have the capacity to implement and enforce it, you won't get anywhere. So it is important as well to make sure that when you have handout and give training on how to use a protocol, that you also supervise its implementation, reward people who adhere to it, and if they don't adhere to it and don't have a solid reason, also show that you don't accept it. What I think is very little use is professional associations and self-regulation amongst them. For instance, I heard that in the NTP programs, often medical associations are included in training, but you can also involve them in, again, adherence to protocols and other measures that are there to improve performance. And I think there's an important need to change the system, to come up with new innovative ideas. For instance, you could think about better involvement of community in facility management, and that we have a direct contact between providers, managers, and community. For instance, that is being experimented with in Zambia. Link performance to pay. There's a number of issues, number of countries, Cambodia, Burundi, Rwanda, where at the moment in this whole district are being contracted out, and health facilities are being rewarded according to their performance, which is measured against indicators such as skilled birth attendance, deliveries with skilled birth attendance. Pardon. And the last one, because of course I've heard a number of interventions that said, well, at the moment we are paying our providers related to performance, there's a huge risk. Huh? People start to work harder, they produce more, but where's the quality? So you have to make sure that there's a quality assurance mechanism, as Chilunga suggested earlier this afternoon, to go along with that. And I think it's important for the NTP programs to slowly consider how can we contribute to this systems development? How can we not only assure that our TB program is functioning well, but because often it is part of an integrated health system, how can we help in improving this system? Because you have an adverse reaction if you only pay for TB services. Like in Zambia, there was a research done on performance improvement, and in certain areas there was no supervision for instance, maternal care, because everyone was going to those supervision visits that were paid for. This is, an important thing to realize. When you have all the funds available, how can we use them to such an extent that other diseases don't suffer? Come to the conclusions. I think from what both Anke and I have been presenting, it is important to think that, to realize that patients have better opportunities for improved access when their rights, responsibilities and priorities are acknowledged. But acknowledgement is one thing. You also need to be able to address it. And as I have been just trying to explain, that is only possible when providers are understanding the needs of the patients and are having the competencies to deal with it, that they receive support in their work so they don't fear that they are able to implement it, they don't fear contamination, they don't feel dissatisfied, and that they are held accountable for their work. So what we're trying to say is there's really time for change and time for a multi-level approach, operationalization of tools for poverty and link it to stigma reduction that I think we have been trying to press this afternoon in various presentations. Standardization of including patients automatically in planning, implementation and evaluation of TB services. Let them be an equal partner. There's a need for new models for service delivery, as I have been just explaining. A need for more operational research, as for instance, narratives of people living with TB, providers living with TB, research on suspects and defaulters, and combining the two. For instance, we are at the moment in Bangladesh engaged in two types of research that are linked to each other, both developing retention and motivation strategies for private, not-for-profit sector workers, and trying to see how patient perspective in these services being seen and how we can combine these two. So overall, and I think that last sentence is for what we have been trying to say with all of us, there's an important challenge for us to empower patients, providers and managers. Thank you.
For the presenters, I think we've had a very interesting afternoon. We started with talking about quality, total quality management, and I think our point of emphasis was there that everybody has to be involved in quality. There must be conformance to standards, but when those standards are defined, the client's perspective must be taken into account. And finally, quality has to be managed if we are going to achieve the goals of our TB programs. Then we went on to talk about actually measuring the patient's perspective, and Jax did a very good job of that. He took us through the quote tool, the background to it, that it measures performance, our performance, against what patients think is important. And he gave us a few examples, and he gave us outcomes of the study in Kenya, Malawi, and Uganda. Then we went on to talk about patient empowerment using peers. And this was an interesting talk from Olav. He talked about patient-centered approach. It focuses on empowerment. And he tried to define empowerment for us. He told us about the materials they are developing, how these materials are empowering the developers because they're involving those people who have had TB and who know what they're talking about. And then he also ended by saying that it's very important to be open, but people need to be trained in order to handle this openness correctly. And he told us how very good, how much better people who've had TB make better treatment supporters than those who just act, you know, theory. You've never had TB, you really don't know how it feels like, but you are the one who knows. And he shared something very interesting about how useful traditional healers can be, those who've had TB and those who are used then as treatment supporters as well as ex-patients. Jeannie gave us a very informative talk on stigma. Thank you for enlightening me. I didn't know there were so many categories of stigma. So I've really been educated this afternoon. And she told us about her review and her work in Zambia. And I think her point of emphasis there are consequences of stigma. A delayed seeking of treatment. People don't want to reveal their TB status because they fear rejection. They interrupt treatment because they don't want to be stigmatized by that treatment. They feel that if I take the treatment, it's an admission that there's something wrong with me. She highlighted the relationship between gender and stigma, how both women and men suffer from stigma, men feeling they lose their status, women fearing rejection. And she emphasized that we need to have participatory anti-stigma education. We need to address the perceived fears of TB, and that there is a research gap in TB and stigma. And this needs to be addressed because we all sing about stigma, and apparently we're not doing much in terms of finding out what could help and what could not, and what should go. And the final presentation was a joint presentation by Anke and Marlene, and they were focusing on, they changed their title. You know, these ladies are very smart. What did you change it to? Anyway, it had to do with human resource development. And that I think Anke started off by bringing our attention to the human factor, poverty, gender, marginalization, identifying barriers in access, what is important in achieving poverty reduction and TB reduction in line with the Millennium Development Goals. She highlighted the new interest in human capacity, and I think we should capitalize on that since there's an interest. But she pointed out that there are no tools in collecting perspectives of patients, and yet these patient perspectives are important, and they're important in relation to gender, age, class, and identity. We ought to know what patients feel and see, and we should address misconceptions on causes and cures of TB, including perceptions of pain of TB by patients. That hasn't been addressed at all. She also pointed out that we need to know how providers themselves feel when they become the victim of TB. Marlene took up the presentation, and she focused on performance in failing systems. She told us how people cope. I wouldn't like to go through that embarrassing list. But some of the things she said was like under the table payments, rude behavior, ignoring protocols, referring to your private clinic so that you can get more money afterwards, and so on. And she suggested some ways of addressing these unethical coping mechanisms, and through training, for example, on-job training, supportive supervision, clinical meetings, peer support, distance learning, self-assessment, and of course, generally, to have support from the workplace. People ought to feel safe. They should have equipment and supplies. There should be clear communication and feedback. management capacity and leadership by those leading, health worker involvement in strategies to improve job satisfaction, redistribution of tasks, accountability of systems, and have an accountability system. And finally, she concluded by saying, look, we should acknowledge the rights, the responsibilities, and priorities of the poor and vulnerable and take action. And the time to take action is now. So that is an overview of the presentations. I think now we can go over to the questions, the question and answer session or comments as you will. Would you like to do that? I think I've talked enough.
Okay, so there is room for questions or remarks, discussion. It would have been nice if you could all sit here, but now we don't have enough chairs. Is that possible?
We can
bring some? Yeah.
Okay.
So please, if you have questions, go to the microphone and...
Thank you. Simon from Uganda. My question is regard to the presentation on court. First of all, I would like to thank all the presenters for their good and very informative presentations. My question is in regard to food. There was the issue that the patients regarded provision of food as, I think, and the services providing food as good quality services or something like that. I'm just interested in knowing whether these were inpatients or outpatients, and if inpatients, were they being provided with cooked food or uncooked food? That is a question. My comment is from the organization for which I work with, that is Malaria Consortium, is being strengthening districts in northern Uganda that are affected by conflict. And the interesting thing here is that one of the agencies providing food provides food to TB patients at the district headquarters level. And basically, the country's policy is to provide TB services at the lower levels. So what has happened is patients travel all the way to the district headquarter level to go to this clinic that provides food. This is uncooked food. And so from the perspective of a provider, we see that the provision of food is disrupting the services. But then, I mean, it's quite interesting that the patient's perspective is different. But my question, that was just a comment, but my question still stands. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. From the qualitative research, it came about that patients really found it important to be supplied with food, and this applied to outpatients mostly. Every time a TB patient has to attend the services, and in some services they are provided with some food package. Okay. So inpatients in the hospital, I take it that they are either provided by the hospital or by their relatives. But that was not what came out of the study.
Okay. Anyone else wants to add something to that? No? You want to add that? Okay.
Thank you very much. Mine is not a question, rather, but a comment. I think... my name is Steve Amolo. Amolo, I come from Kenya. A community person representing a very small patient community from Kenya. I want to say that I'm very grateful for all the presenters because this is really was a patient-focused discussion. And I want to say that there was a big balance on the issues of the patient and the patient and the healthcare provider. I want to thank you for all that. More often than not, you find that a lot of emphasis is usually put on probably developing and strengthening the health facilities. That is both infrastructure and the healthcare provider, probably in terms of availability or availing laboratories, so on and so forth, training the healthcare providers or clinicians to gain this and that strength. But very little is usually done to empower the patients within the communities also. Now, I think if the approach that has been discussed here today could be really followed to the latter, then I think we are going to have a very balanced kind of process where we are not going to really strain on either side. If you take very closely, especially when it comes to adherence to treatment, which eventually actually leads to development of the MDR-TB, XDR-TB now, is because probably if the patient fails to take medication as required. And more often, when a clinician puts a lot of effort that you have to take medication, you have to take medication, you find that patients really behave differently. They actually feel like they are intimidated. I mean, they are reprimanded. Then they even stop going for that care. If you take the reverse, where the fellow patient, also having gone through this or is also on treatment by that time, tries to give advice to this kind of a person or a patient, you find that they really cope very well and adherence is adhered to. They take medication to completion. One funny thing with TB treatment, as I went through TB treatment some time back, is that within a very short time, you feel like you are getting better. And most of TB patients tend to think that they are now cured and they stop treatment. Now, if that so happens in a person, I mean, with a person who comes from the interior of the community, who has got to spend a lot of money, which is not even there sometimes for him or her, and he feels better and feels like, I don't have any reason to visit the hospital again. Now, who is the closest person to help this person? The same community person who has been a patient. Now, what you'd want to see is, researches have been done, and a lot of them are being done still. But research is just not enough. After doing that research, you have a very wonderful outcome. You present it in a conference like this, very high-level conference. How are you going to implement it? It takes centuries for you to think of the community you are talking about. Because the research that has been done probably is just done in Kenya, Uganda, and very selected countries. But even after that research, it takes centuries to look to see this being implemented, even in the very, very country where the research has been carried on. Sometimes you talk of patients were involved, and this was the outcome. But we don't see the acknowledgement of those very patients being brought to a conference like this. We don't see the organizations of patients that were also involved in such a research being brought up to this. But we see acknowledgement of the scientists, doctors, clinicians who participated in that kind of research. We want to see a situation where patients are seen as partners in this treatment. And when it comes to HIV and TB treatment, I think this has changed the feeling that the doctor knows it all. Patients also need to participate and take care of their own treatment plan. And I want to say this, that if we would develop the capacity of both the patient and the health facility, then what remains is to develop and formalize the linkages between this, the community and the healthcare centers or facilities. You'll find defaulters rate will reduce tremendously. Because if we develop such kind of linkages and trust, then the community will take upon themselves that I do this, I refer my friend, my colleague, my this or that facility, and the facility recognizes that, it will be quite easy for us to take control of the defaulters. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for reminding us that patients are not only to be partners in bringing treatment, they are already partners in research and should then be partners in bringing the research into action. Anyone? No? There, yeah.
I'm Joseph Banda from Zambia. Currently, the National TB Program in Zambia is reviewing the TB manual. And one aspect that we are considering is the infection control. And in that, what we have emphasized is the control of transmission of TB within health settings. And one intervention that we are proposing in that is that TB suspects should not spend too much time in the health facilities. And so we are proposing that these TB suspects be identified quickly. They go through the system very quickly to try and protect the other patients. And yesterday, I was in some presentation somewhere where already some other countries doing this. I've just forgotten where. They have one person who goes around picking out TB suspects to try and protect the other patients from catching TB in case these people have TB and they're transmitting that. From what Chirunga has been presenting today, those kind of interventions would tend to stigmatize against those same TB suspects. How do you hope to compromise this so that whilst protecting the public good, we also take into consideration the feelings of and the dignity of these patients that we are trying to isolate?
Okay, thank you. Chirunga, have you already found a solution for that?
No, I don't have a solution because that is the dilemma we have. Perhaps it might be an idea to involve some TB patients and see how they would want to go about it, those who have suffered from TB. But I would be lying if I said we have a solution. We don't have a solution. But it's a problem we have observed. You know, you try to fast track these people and then turn around and say you're discriminating against us. So it is a dilemma. But I think it's something that one could discuss with ex-patients and see how you could go about it in a less dramatic and less stigmatizing way, where it's not obvious that you're picking me up because I'm a TB patient. Jackson?
I'm very happy that you brought this up because in my organization, which is the KNCV, the TB Association. Last week we had to choose which of those masks we should wear ourselves if we are visiting, especially countries where there is MDR or XDR TB. Because you definitely run a risk if you become infected with XDR TB. There's nobody in the world who's going to treat you. It has a high mortality rate. So I don't know the answers. I don't know even if I would really start wearing a mask like that in the first place, especially if the ventilation is okay. But I agree, if you have to write a manual with infection control, it is written, negative flow, air masks, or special masks, so it's a problem. What we see from countries like China, for example, is that everybody with a common cold is wearing a surgical mask on the streets, on the bicycle. So I don't know whether there is some wisdom to be gathered from. For example, in every patient who coughs wears a protective mask or something, or in order not to stigmatize only the TB patients. It is work in progress, and we don't have any clear-cut answers. It's an issue. And I agree with Chilu, why not ask the patients how they feel about it?
Okay. I think Olaf Ahlberg still wanted to react to some earlier remarks, isn't it?
No, I'd just like to mention that I'm happy for the question. I think it's quite relevant, the one you asked about where are the patients here as well and the representatives from the organizations. And I'm sorry that you didn't participate in our postgrad course on Tuesday, because there we had representatives from countries surrounding your country. From various organizations and former TB patients reporting from the research they had done in this work in progress that I was talking about in my speech. And there were people from Com.Temeke, Tanzania, there were from Panduka in Namibia, there were Pasada from Tanzania, CHEP from Zambia, Paradiso from Malawi. They were all patient-focused organizations, patient-driven organizations, who are here reporting from the work they had done, the development of communication material they had done together with us, and the research they themselves had done. And I agree with you, we should do a lot more of it, because I think that is the most effective measure we can take. So I'm happy for your comment. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, next question. Oh, Jean, I'm sorry. Then before that, I think Ginny wanted to also react, and then we get to your question.
Yeah, just a very quick response to Dr. Banda. I mean, he's opened a huge can of worms there, really, for TB, so well done. because it's really a big issue for TB, because definitely one of the key causes of TB stigma is public health practice around TB. And some people have this idea that there is some form of fair differential treatment. So the idea that could be considered a form of fair differential treatment. And some people don't agree with that. They don't feel that's the case. And I mean, I think the problem is that indeed it could be experienced as stigmatizing. So you have this sort of public good pitted against private pain, if you like. And this is a sort of constant juggle that we face. But all I would say is that very easily, and particularly in the context of HIV, that public practice around preventing TB transmission can very easily become exaggerated and accentuated and carried out in too obvious a way, and can have stigmatizing consequences. But I don't know, maybe I'd suggest that we sort of change the structure of the clinic before we did that, like we had better ventilation systems, or rather than picking the patients out, changing the structure. But I think it's a really big problem in TB control.
And
Christian Aero from... Yeah, they seem to be on
here. Christian Aero from the Philippines, working in MDR project, and actually we all wear masks. The patients all have surgical masks, and the providers fill the mask. I just wanted to mention about the former patients becoming DOD providers, and I think you, Olaf Alberg, mentioned that there's evidence it works well. I think it would be very good to publish that, or to have a review article, or maybe a small booklet through WHO, because I also think that's really a way forward to involve former patients. But I don't think that at the moment there's a lot that can be read about this.
We do have some studies that are presented now just recently in this postgrad course, and I'll be happy to forward what we have to you and to bring you in touch with the people that are carrying out these studies. So you have my email on the presentation, if you have it. If not, I'll be happy to give it to you afterwards.
Yeah, Martin.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much to the organizers for this, I think, very important topic. I was sorry that I did not. I missed the first 2.5 speakers. I ended when Virginia was halfway. And I missed a little bit, really, the perspectives. I'm very interested not so much in the patient's perspective in TB control, but more of the TB control. And we all know that we have a global strategy that is DOTS, and we have that is a kind of framework to deliver services. And if we don't give the services, 50% die of the patients. And if you do it a little bit good, more die. And if you do it very well, we have a 85% cure rate. The point, to my opinion, is really, how is this strategy good, or is it working good in a country, or not good enough, or good but? And in order to find that out, I think it is important to find this idea of the perspectives of the patients. Now, I learned a lot in the last hour, a lot of what we should do, what I call them the controllers, what we should do. I wonder if it is possible to merge it a little bit in 2 or 3 or 4 key issues what we should do. But the most striking thing is what I found, that we should come with, or it is at least suggested by Marjolein, to come with a new model of TB control. And I'm wondering a little bit on that, because so far I thought we have a model that is the DOTS strategy framework, and based on studies, based on listening to the patients, we can improve it, we can adapt it and modify this. But now here is a suggestion, come with a new model. Is that really true, or not so much?
Okay, Marjolein, you want to react?
Maybe we have some confusion about the word model. What I meant to say was it is important to see how you can reorganize the control strategy that is in place given the human resources that are there. For instance, there's a very interesting case I attended the other day with the Philippines where they actually had to reduce the TB control program from quite a number of people to very few because of the health sector reforms. And they the responsibilities for the program went to the local government units, and they managed through all these changes to still keep the TB high on the political agenda. And they worked with a lot of volunteers. Now, what I think is important is that you really look for those alternatives and see what has happened that it worked in a changed circumstance, because the impression that sometimes you get listening to presentations, oh, we will get more money so we can continue the way we always have continued. But we all know that resources are limited, that other diseases are emerging, that sometimes disease control strategies are competing with each other. And that in that way, I think there's a new, there's time for innovative redistribution of tasks, redistribution of incentives. Maybe the TB control program should, for instance, think about, instead of giving special incentives for their TB activities, to more think about how can we contribute to improving salaries, things like that. And I don't have the answers, but I think it is time to really already start thinking about how can we better integrate, and there are already a lot of efforts going on. How can we better document these, and how can we better share them with each other and plan now, because maybe in 5 years' time that money isn't there anymore. That's what I meant.
Okay, I think it's about time. Well, you have another question? Yeah? Okay, then we make that the last question or remark.
My name's Evelyn Harvey. I work with Health and Development Networks. Thanks to everyone for a very informative and relevant session. Returning to the issues of stigma and XDR-TB specifically, I think there's a danger at the moment of very sensationalist reporting of the problem of XDR, which is going to lead to panic among health workers, increased stigma of TB patients, the stigma that arises through outright fear. And actually, although XDR-TB is very challenging to manage and treat in patients, there's no epidemiological evidence that it's any more highly infectious. So the infection control, well, we'll probably know more about that as lab capacity improves and as epidemiological studies can be done. But at the moment, it's important to keep infection control measures that are not stigmatizing, or, you know, that patients can accept as part of all TB control, and not to use XDR as a means to introduce draconian measures that will stigmatize all TB patients or suspected TB patients. And of course, my final point would be that the emergence of increasingly MDR and XDR strains means that it's even more imperative to encourage and support patients to continue with their treatment and to finish courses of treatment so we don't end up making the problem worse. Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, thank you all very, very much. I think it has been a very interesting symposium. We heard that there are many different dimensions to the patient or client perspective, if you like. Which vary from the dimensions of quality and acceptability of services, satisfaction, but also the relationship patient to its provider, the relationship patient towards the community, the relationship of the patient towards himself. The other, I think, very important element that we got from this is that it's on one hand the patient perspective and on the other hand the provider needs, and we should not forget about it. And I think one thing which didn't come out later or not in the discussion, but what we have to find ways of dealing with, is that we should not by focusing so much on the client perspective and using that as a evaluation tool of provision of care, towards and providers which and healthcare providers that are already under a lot of stress and have a lot of difficulties, that it doesn't end up being a discouraging tool, but that we find a way of actually using it as a encouraging tool, that, so to get to satisfaction of clients so that it can be encouraging. So I think that that will be the biggest challenge that we are facing, and if we can do that, then it might really improve everything. So thank you very, very much, and that's it.